Hello everyone, it's August 18th, 2015, so I keep using this intro to explain production issues. In today's show we have rain. It was pouring just outside my window, but you probably won't notice it. And besides, for a podcast, bad weather is no reason to delay a perfectly good liftoff. And we've cleared the tower. Welcome to episode number 20 of the Orbital Mechanics Podcast. I'm David.
I'm Ben. Can you believe that we got to episode 20 already?
Well, it's been, what, eight, nine months or whatever.
Yeah.
But it seems, you know, I don't know if it seems like a longer period of time than that or shorter. I'm not quite sure.
Yeah,
which,
exactly. It kind of flip-flops back and forth.
Yeah, it's incredible. It's been 20 episodes. Although, now that we're doing them weekly, we're going to, I mean, we'll be at 30 within like a couple months.
Yeah, we'll blaze through it.
Yeah, well, now we're going to start blazing through it.
50 episodes a year, man.
How that works out? No, wait a minute. Wouldn't it be?
It'd be 52 if we didn't miss any weeks, and I'm guessing we're going to miss some weeks. So
okay, which means that 100 is 2 years, 300. Okay, wow. You know that I was just listening to a podcast. I won't say which. They were up around 2,500.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's funny because I was just talking to my wife Annalise. She just started listening to My Brother and Me, which is an amazing comedy podcast that everybody should listen to. And they were talking to somebody. I don't remember what the context was, but they basically said, yeah, we've been doing this for, you know, 6 years. And it's kind of crazy because, yeah, they've been doing that for 6 years, you know, but 2000 episodes, geez.
Yeah. That's doing probably three a week or so.
Yeah.
So
you've got to be doing multiples a week or you're stretching back too far.
And doing it since 2000. I don't know when podcasts first became a thing, but about as early as it goes. I mean, 2003, maybe, was that when podcasts?
I think the first named podcast was around 2000. The idea was around since the 80s.
Well, oh, whatever.
But okay, yeah, actual podcasts.
Are you making reference to that guy that wants, that's, you know, that's filing that patent troll guy who says,
the patent,
podcast?
The patent troll's been beat, because they were able to show prior art back in the 80s. So
I hate patent trolls. That is a whole other can of worms. All right. Well, let's do spaceflight news. That's why we're all here. Number one is Vasimir. This is interesting because it's Vasimir, really. You know, and I saw the article and I started reading it thinking that this was going to be about, we discussed it some time ago about how the International Space Station might start using Vasimir for station keeping. As it turns out, I don't think that that's what this is about, but it is a partnership that that Ad Astra, the company that, you know, has developed the Vasimir engine, they have partnered up with NASA. There's a specific NASA program called the Next Space Technologies for Exploration Partnership, or Next Step. And they're going to fund 50% of the cost of development of the engine. And the goal that Ad Astra has is to get the Vasimir thruster, which maybe we should talk. Do you want to talk a little bit about what it is?
Well, we talked about it a little in the past, and we were mostly talking about it, about its viability as an interplanetary mode of transport, right?
Right. Which I still don't think it's particularly, very viable.
No, it's horrible. You can't get to Mars with a Vasimir engine, but
no,
it works great for space stations and that kind of thing. So
right. But that's exactly what they're apparently not testing, or they're not focusing on that. What they are focusing on is testing out the engine for long periods of time. So what they want to do is they want to have it running for a minimum of 100 hours straight at a power input of 100 kilowatts. And that's going to give them some idea of how reliable this thruster is over a long period of time. From the tests that have been done so far, there's no wear on the various components because it's all, I mean, you have thrust that is generated by this plasma of argon or krypton, I think, but it doesn't actually touch the inner walls.
Yeah, that's fantastic.
So it seems to work very well. But the big problem, again, we had discussed a while ago, was just that if you're trying to get to Mars with it, you're going to need a huge amount of power. Way more than it's practical. I mean, how do you, you would have to have, a nuclear powered source.
Yeah. You'd have to have a nuclear generator, like a fission generator. Yeah. And, that's not going to happen.
Well, not anytime soon, I guess.
Not anytime soon. Yeah. And let's point out that 100 hours of continuous operation is standard for this kind of an engine. Current ion technology runs for longer than that, usually while it's in space. We're usually talking, you know, a month on and a month off and then a month on and then a month off or something on that scale. 100 hours is pretty basic, so.
The past experiments that they have done thus far, they've gotten it up to 6 newtons of thrust, which is a very small amount of thrust, and a specific impulse of 5,000 seconds. Now, that's very efficient, and that, of course, is where this type of technology shines. designs, both with this and traditional ion thrusters, is that they have very high specific impulse, but very, 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 very low thrust. One thing that I kind of wonder about, since we have determined it's not going to be good for interplanetary travel necessarily, why not just use a traditional ion thruster in the first place? Because I'm just wondering if you're going to need to vary the thrust, which is exactly what this engine is designed to do. But again, you can vary it between maybe like 6 newtons and 10 or something like that. I mean, it's very small amounts of difference in thrust. But this does seem very useful for station keeping. So I think that's what they should be focusing on. Now, I think later on, or is it sometime this year or sometime next year, they are going to be shipping up a Vasimir engine to the space station to do whatever they're going to do up there. I don't know if they're going to try to use it for station keeping. That would be the first thing that comes to my mind. I don't know if that's what the tests
Where would they attach it? I mean, I don't know if there are any really good hard points on the outside of the station to attach it to.
The truss rod, right? Wouldn't that kind of work?
Yeah, it might. I don't know if there are any really good tie downs. And if it's on, let's say, the Z0, so the small segment of truss that's directly connected to the living quarters, I guess. If you were to connect it there, you'd have to point it almost directly down so that the thrust went through the center of gravity. So that's not a great place to put it.
You would need to do that. That's true. But considering how low the thrust is, you know, you certainly don't have to worry about securing it on something that is, you know, they can withstand huge loads. I mean, because that's just not going to happen.
Do you know what the upgraded version that they're talking about now is going to be doing? So 6 newtons of thrust is what, like a pound and a half? So what's the 10 kilowatt version going to be doing? Do you know?
No, but if it's 10 kilowatts, it would be...
Or 100 kilowatts is what the contract is for.
Yeah, well, it really depends on how you vary the thrust, because you could use the same amount of power and you can get very good specific impulse at low thrust, or not so good specific impulse at higher thrust. I'm not sure what the number is in newtons or pounds or whatever. Suffice to say, it's still very low. I mean, like, even operating at its highest thrust capacity, it's still such a small amount of thrust that's generated. So it is a very limited piece of hardware in that sense. I just wonder what it's actually going to be useful for. The only thing we can think of is station keeping, right? Because other than that, I just don't know how it would work on an interplanetary mission. I just don't see why you would need it.
I mean, it would be great for a probe going to, say, another comet or something, because it's small and you need insane amounts of delta V. But yeah, for moving anything more than, you know, a small science payload, yeah, it doesn't really work.
Yeah, that's all I have to say about Vasimir. I just wanted to point that out to any Vasimir fans out there.
Yeah, it's cool technology.
We're going to translate on over to our next topic. This one involves vegetables.
Yeah, space vegetables. So there's this experiment on station called Veggie, and I'd always seen it spelled V-E-G-G-E, all in caps. And as I was putting the notes together this week, I could not for the life of me figure out where I had seen that and what Veggie was supposed to stand for, because now NASA's just calling it the Veggie experiment, and the full name is the Vegetable Production Workshop or something like that. Anyway, so Veggie is this really cool little booth that has full spectrum. Actually, no, they're not full spectrum. They're LEDs that are grow LEDs. They're biased towards the red side of the spectrum because that's what plants pick up best. So it's this expandable little area with plastic around the edges and lights up at the top. And then at the bottom, you've got space for what they call pillows. And they're just little paper packets filled with some sort of nutrient medium, some sort of, what's the word?
Dirt?
It is dirt, but they call it substrate. Jeez Louise.
Okay.
So they're these little... They're these little pillows full of substrate, and they've got, you know, a lot of nutrients in them. And each one comes with a little seed in the middle and a little slot that you can open up. And so once these pillows get to station, they can slot 4 of them, I believe. It might be 9 into the Veggie enclosure. And then they water them and the seeds germinate and start to grow. And we've done a lot of plant growth experiments on station before. What's really cool about Veggie is that it is aimed at practicality. So instead of doing an experiment and going, oh, well, here's a model organism, let's see how it grows, and then let's analyze how it grows and that kind of thing, Veggie is more about producing food to eat and flowers that are pretty to look at.
I'm watching the YouTube video right now, which we'll have a link to, and the astronauts are okay, first of all, what is it that they're growing here? It looks like kale, maybe? Is that?
No, it's actually not kale. Believe it or not, that is red lettuce.
Okay.
Yeah,
so it's red
definitely
lettuce.
Looks like kale. It red lettuce already doesn't grow in a nice head like iceberg does, but it gets really wavy and really big, and it looks different up there. But yeah, it's just red lettuce. And what's interesting is that it doesn't taste like regular lettuce. Apparently, it tastes a little bit like arugula, which is pretty cool. So a little peppery spiciness. But this is actually the second harvest of Veggie. The first harvest was wrapped up in aluminum foil and then frozen and shipped back on a dragon, I believe. Yeah, it would have had to have been a dragon, right? Because there's nothing else coming down.
Nothing else, yep.
And they made sure that there weren't any bacteria growing on it and that there, you know, it was edible and good to eat, which I think is very, very conservative to do all that. But hey, you really don't want people up there getting sick. So this is the second batch, and they were allowed to eat what they grew. I'm pretty sure they are sending a good deal of it back, but they were at least allowed to eat a leaf each. There are a bunch of pillows left over. They shipped up more than they needed. So this batch, I believe, is from the original shipment. I don't know. I think they might have shipped up extras, but I don't know if they used the second batch or if this is still from the first batch. But they talked about having some flowers to grow and look nice, which will be interesting given that the enclosure is made out of red plastic and the LED lights are very reddish, pinkish, purplish kind of color. And flowers do look best in white light, you know, evolutionarily speaking. So so we'll see what they do. It's pretty cool.
I'm watching the video right now, like I said, and there's Scott Kelly up there, two other astronauts, and they're putting, by the way, I don't know what they're putting. They have a little bottle, like a little dropper bottle of something, and they're putting it on the lettuce as they eat it. So I guess maybe it's salad dressing. I have no idea.
I know that Scott Kelly was bragging about having lettuce on his hamburger. He took, they do hamburger pretty often where they get a little hamburger patty and some mustard and ketchup, and they wrap everything up in a tortilla, and usually they'll put cheese sauce on there too. And he put some lettuce in there, and he was very happy about having lettuce in his meal.
I bet I bet they do get fresh fruits and vegetables. But
yes, they get
probably
fresh fruits and vegetables, but I don't think that they get lettuce. I think that's too hard to ship up there.
For whatever reason, I love eggplant, so.
Ooh, that'd be tough. I think any fruiting vegetables are going to be really tough. Just because it takes so much water and energy to produce any sort of fruit. But leafy vegetables, I mean, are simple as anything. So I would want maybe a variety of greens and have a salad or something. That sounds really good.
Well, before I get any hungrier, do you want to move on?
So this next news item is really cool. We're slowly making progress towards a return to flight by what's their name? Orbital ATK.
Orbital ATK, yep.
The Antares rocket is one step closer to flying back to station.
Yep. The target is 2016, so they're thinking that they can do their next resupply to the ISS by sometime in early 2016. Now, as we all remember, they had that huge failure back in, was it late 2014, late last year. So all things considered, I guess this is a pretty good turnaround time for them because they had to rebuild the pad to a large extent because it was pretty well trashed.
It was a lot better than we all expected it to be. They had to replace some stuff, but yeah.
But so the cool thing is that they have, well, semi-cool. I guess it's a bittersweet thing. So they're getting new engines, actual new engines. The old ones used to be the AJ-26s, which were basically modified from Russian NK-33s. Now, these engines were made back in, I think, the 60s. They were physically made then, and that is what they were using, and that is why they had that failure, is just because they...
Well, not only were they old, but they weren't being stored in a good in a good situation.
Right. So there was, you know, corrosion and other issues. So what Orbital did is they said, well, we're going to need new engines. And so they're going with the RD-181, which is a very similar engine built by the Russians again.
Yeah, it's basically another NK-33. I mean, it's basically the NK-33's great-grandson.
Exactly, yeah. Pretty much the same thing. One cool thing, though, is that it is a higher thrust engine. It gets about 3,700 kilonewtons as opposed to the old engine, which was 3,265, which is about 100 million more pounds of thrust. So it's definitely a nice upgrade. And just so listeners know, this is an RP-1 LOX stage combustion engine. If you don't know what that means, I guess go back and listen to the episode where we talked about that.
And it's also a dual, what do they call it? Not a dual nozzle. It actually has two separate combustion chambers, but they share a lot of their equipment. They share fuel back and forth.
I think they share the same turbo pump.
Is it the same turbo pump as well?
I think.
Yeah, but it's two rockets that are tied together very, very closely, which is, you know, exactly what the NK-33 was. Aerojet Rocketdyne looked at switching to two single engines, but it just didn't turn out to work with the architecture that they had. Basically, by doing this upgrade, they had to do very, very, very little modifications to their actual vehicle. In fact, they barely had to move the support posts around for the engine. So it's a pretty easy transition for them.
There are some changes that they have to make, but in the grand scheme of things, it's not too bad, which is why they're able to, you know, most likely be back running by 2016. So yeah, that's good. We'll be seeing launches again from Wallops, and hopefully, you know, in less than a year's time. Overall, I think it's a happy story. I would like to see, however, I would like to have seen them switch to some other kind of engine, not because I dislike Russia or anything, but it's always good to see companies here just working a little bit harder to build their own hardware, which ultimately is a cheaper way to go.
Yeah, well, you know, Orbital ATK wasn't gonna be building their own hardware or their own engine, not at this point, not for this vehicle. But do you know when they're gonna do the extended version of the Antares rocket?
No, I do not.
Okay, so their higher thrust means that they can actually push more uphill, and they were talking about building an extended version with bigger tanks, and I was hoping you knew when that was going
to
fly.
I didn't hear anything about that. Well, I'll look into it. Well, maybe we'll talk about it next week. I don't want to search for it just yet. But it's really Aerojet Rocketdyne, right? Because these are the people who actually make the engine. So I guess what I should have said was, why isn't Aerojet Rocketdyne building their own engines, better engines? Because I think that they certainly could be. They have made some very impressive engines in the past. So why is it that we still have to...
They're already working on other stuff, so...
I guess so. Yeah. I'm just being...
They don't have a customer right now for a new engine, right? It's not like they could have built it in time for Orbital ATK to use it,
right.
So...
Yeah, exactly. I know. They're under a time crunch, and so the best thing you can do is purchase them from the Russians. But at the time that this accident happened last year, I'm not even sure that the RD-181 was under development, because that is a fairly new engine. I mean, it is largely based on the NK-33, RD-191, I believe. I don't remember all these numbers.
I think it's the 191.
Yeah. I believe the company is Energomash. I can never remember. I believe that that's the Russian company that built these engines. But they have done a really good job. They've gotten them ready to go, and they're shipping 20 of them to Orbital ATK. So it's pretty much all set to go. But that's good. I'm glad to have Orbital ATK back.
Yeah, they're a cool company.
And I guess that's all the news we want to cover this week, huh?
Yeah.
It was not a huge... This has been 2 weeks now. I guess if we were doing a two-week show still, we would have more than enough. But as it turns out, doing 1 week at a time, yeah, it can, you know, it can be
Well, imagine having to do all of this news and all the news from the last show in one go.
Right,
that's what it would
exactly.
have been.
And we're still we still cherry pick quite a bit, because there's always a lot more. There's a lot more going on. We haven't talked at all about other things going on, such as changes in leadership at NASA. I was going to talk about that last week, but then I was like, nah, never mind. But maybe we'll talk about that at some point.
We could have talked about the
RS-25
testing, but
ooh, yeah.
We think we've got a better way to address that later on. So we'll see.
Okay, stand by. We're looking at it.
All right, well, let's move on, I guess, to questions, comments, and corrections. Correction burns. We have a good one this week. Indeed. So we have a listener by the name of, I'll just call him, what's his name?
Roshan.
Roshan.
Sheriff.
Roshan. He emailed us and he had a really big correction for us. So last week we were talking about the
Akatsuki.
The Akatsuki spacecraft. And you were explaining to me why it was that the engines on that spacecraft had overheated, specifically because they weren't getting the right amount of oxidizer. So you had given me an explanation, which made sense to me.
Hey, it made sense to me too.
But as it turns out, we were wrong. So do you want to explain exactly what it was?
Let me just read verbatim
what
Roshan sent in, because this is pretty good. So he says, hey guys, let's see, I just want to point out that in your latest episode, there's an incorrect explanation of why oxidizer-rich combustion is hotter. The energy of combustion depends only on how much fuel oxidizer reacts, not on which makes up more of the mixture. So burning them at the optimal or stoichiometric ratio produces the most energy, and increasing either fuel or oxidizer makes less energy for the propellant mass used. The reason oxidizer-rich combustion is hotter is because the leftover oxidizer is lighter per molecule than fuel would be. So the same amount of energy moves the molecules faster and therefore hotter. The oxidizer has a lower heat capacity than fuel, is how you actually say that in technical terms. If you had a fuel that was lighter than the oxidizer, like in a Hydrolox engine, then running fuel-rich would be hotter. So really what it all comes down to is just the molecular mass of each of the combustion participants, I guess. And that makes a lot more sense. So, yeah, you know what? It's been ages since I've actually studied stoichiometry, and I know that that's really what it all comes down to, but for some reason in my head, that wasn't what was the explanation. So, yeah, thank you so much, Roshan.
And, okay, so I also want to mention, just a couple hours ago, just before we started recording, I actually sent him some follow-up questions, and he did respond to me. So, just to clarify here, on the Akatsuki spacecraft, the fuel and oxidizer that's used is hydrazine and nitrogen tetroxide. As it turns out, and this is what he said, the nitrogen tetroxide, that actually is heavier by molecule because you have four oxygen atoms as opposed to four hydrogen atoms, which is what, you know, the hydrazine is. So he said in his response that, that doesn't make sense. So there must be something else going on there. He said that from what he could gather, because there isn't much in English on this, most of it is in Japanese, obviously, so you have to use Google Translate. And Google Translate's not the best at translating Japanese. But the fuel nozzle apparently is cooled by a film, a lower temperature film of fuel. So maybe what happened was that film was supposed to be the oxidizer, and they didn't have enough of it. Maybe that's why it overheated. There's just no way of knowing, really, unless you speak Japanese. So if we have any Japanese listeners out there who know more about this, let us know. Nonetheless, what he responded with actually is, you know, very important and I believe correct. I'm not a chemist, but that makes sense to me. So yeah, again, we're very thankful. I love learning little new things like this. This is, you know, the funnest part.
Yeah. So as a follow-up, let me read verbatim from an iTunes review we got. So this is from Chris Radcliffe.
Okay. Yeah. The next one, Chris Radcliffe.
Yeah. Chris says, like with any conversation, the occasional factual error gets corrected eventually and usually sparks an interesting conversation of its own. Chris, I couldn't have said it better. That is absolutely exactly what happens on the show. Because I don't know, it's been maybe 10 shows since we've said this. David and I are by no means are we professionals. So what's really amazing about this show is the community that's kind of swelled up around it. We have all these fans that can fix what we don't know, and together we all get smarter, and I think that's really, really cool.
That's the funnest thing, is that it's sort of an ongoing conversation. At least that's what I want it to be. I might not always be the best at fostering that. I know I probably need to spend a little bit more time on the subreddit, for example, but I do like the ongoing conversation between people who essentially know more than you do. You know what I mean? Yeah. It's like, you know, you have listeners who are experts or at least much more educated on something, and that's how I learn, and that's how the other audience members who didn't know that we'll learn as well. So the ongoing conversation by means of a, you know, pre-recorded podcast. Maybe one day we'll start doing regular live ones. That would be even better. That might change the format
quite
a bit. Yeah. Because I can certainly foresee some conversation sort of happening right in the middle of the show. And that's when your show starts going, you know, 2-3 hours long. So we have to be careful about that as well.
Well, one day maybe we'll just become a big hive mind and we'll all know everything.
There's that too. You know, you could always join the Board Collective, or any other collective for that matter. So I think that's all we have to say. And you wanted to mention, of course, we would be remiss if we didn't mention Patreon, because we just started that last week and we've met with some pretty pretty good results, huh?
Yeah, so we're currently sitting at 23 contributors, and we are bringing in $182 a month. Keep in mind that's actually higher than what we'll really get, because we have to pay Patreon 10%, and then we have to basically pay for all of your credit card transaction fees. So that'll probably come in around $160, $170, but that's an incredible amount of money that we totally did not expect to bring in. So thank you so much, you guys.
We're going to name some people here specifically, people who have contributed at least to our, our flight director level, which is $20 plus. So we want to just say a quick thank you to them. We're just going to go down the list here. We're going to, number one, first of all, we have Maxwell Vanderleeden. I think I said that right.
Then we have James Sutherland. Thank you, James.
He of the great book suggestions. Next one is Tony Orell, or Tony Orell. Thank you, Tony.
Yeah, thank you, Tony. Then we have Ben Higginbotham from Tomorrow. Thank you so much, Ben. That's really fantastic.
Yes, TMRO.
Yeah, we actually got our first big listener bump from Tomorrow. They mentioned us on their patron-only what they call it, After Dark. It's like a little extended after show. And they mentioned us on there, and we got a pretty big bump. Thank you so much, Ben. We really appreciate it.
And last but not least, we have Brian Taylor, and who also, I'll be mentioning him later. He gave us a nice iTunes review. So thank you, Brian.
Okay. Oh, yeah, that was him, wasn't it? And then we also have three more people. They're also flight directors, but they were fast enough to get the early bird special. So first we have Kona Fari. Thank you, Kona.
And then Chris Radcliffe. He's always, well, I was going to say something about him, but we've been having a lot of interesting Twitter conversations with Chris.
Yes.
So thank you, Chris.
Yeah, Chris is a big space guy. He is the founder of SpaceUp. So go check that out if you get a chance. And then our last early bird special is Andrew Drummond. And he put in his nickname. So he says Andrew Smeagol Drummond. Thanks, Smeagol.
Thank you, Smeagol. And that, I guess that's all the ones we're going to mention today, huh?
Yeah. Before we move on, let's just summarize how fantastic this week was. So we blew through three of our goals. So our first goal was just, you know, basic costs. And that went within a couple hours. That was $50. And then we also blew through the patches and t-shirt goals. So congratulations, everybody. We are now going to be selling patches and t-shirts.
We have, well, so your plan is to send one to, I think, everyone,
you
right?
know what? Here, okay, so the patches are so cheap. I think there's a chance that some of our patrons are going to be getting one for free. We'll see. I'm not going to say any more than that. But patches will be sold on our website, and they'll be sold at cost, which should be a couple of bucks. And yeah, I mean, we're not going to make any money off of that, and I will be just mailing them out. If you're interested, do join our patron campaign, because I'll be asking our patrons some preferences on patches, whether they want iron-on or what, how big they want them to be, how flashy they should be. And then the t-shirts are going to be similar. We're going to be doing a campaign on Teespring, and we'll be getting that up just as soon as we can, so maybe by the end of the year, if we're lucky. But we'll put a couple of designs up. I've got a design that I really want to do. If we have a couple of designs that we can't pick from, we'll let the patrons vote. So if you're interested, do get on Patreon and get a word in there. But we'll also be doing t-shirts. Like I said, those will be going through Teespring. Teespring just changed the way they charge for t-shirts. So we're gonna see how little we can charge for those. We're gonna really try to save as much money for you guys on those as we can. But yeah, those will be going up hopefully by the end of the year, as well as the patches. They'll probably be arriving around the same time. So
lots to look forward to.
Yeah. So one big thing to look forward to is we are $60 away. Less than $60 away from our monthly Google Hangout goal.
Yeah, already.
And that's, yeah, I know, isn't that crazy? So that's $240. And then the goal after that is $800 a month. And that's like nothing. That's really not a real goal. It was just in there just in case. And you guys almost hit my just in case. So we need something between $240 and $800. So if you guys think of anything that you'd really like to see us do, let us know, and we'll go ahead and add an extra goal in there somewhere. So let us know.
Very excited to have all these new patrons, and I have to say, it definitely is going to help. One thing that it covers all of our basic costs, first of all. But as we discussed the last episode, and I won't go into it, we do need some equipment upgrades and just some additional equipment. So I'm planning, hopefully, at the end of the month, I'll be doing, you know, I'll be going to Kennedy Space Center to see a ULA launch. I would like to talk to some people and maybe, you know, get some recordings, but I don't have any such device to do that. I think you still have you have your little handheld recorder, right, Ben?
Yeah, I do.
But I don't have one. And you had suggested I use my phone. I did some tests with it, you know, just talking, and you know, it does not sound great. So things of that nature that will help us, you know, get out there and go places and do interviews and so forth. I really want to make that happen. And this is what will allow that to happen. So yeah. Once again, I don't want to belabor the point. I'm not good at asking for money personally. Ben, you say that you are. So, so I'll leave it there and just say thanks, guys. We really do appreciate it.
This could not have been a better week for us. I mean, just waking up every morning and checking my email and seeing that we had new patrons seriously lining up to give us money. That's really fantastic. And I guarantee you we're going to use this money in a good way. We're going to produce a better product for you. So thank you so much for the faith that you guys have in us.
So let's go to upcoming spaceflight events. Do we have anything this week?
Yes, we actually have one launch this week. After 2 weeks of delays and then yet another week of delays from HTV, we do actually have another launch that we've caught up to. So we're going to have an Ariane 5 launching on August 20th, and I do not see an ETA. So pay attention to, I guess, twitter.com/nextlaunch for that. And it is launching from Ariane Launch Area 3 down in French Guiana, and it is launching Eutelsat 8 West B and Intelsat 38. So Eutelsat is a TV satellite that is covering the Middle East and North Africa. We've talked about that one in a bit more detail, so we're going to skip that. And then Intelsat is, I believe, a civilian communication satellite. Is that correct?
In Launch Library, it says it will bring replacement relay capacity for two other satellites at 304.5 degrees east longitude.
Yeah, the Intelsat network is huge. Obviously, they're up to 34 now. So, and I think it's funny that Intelsat is built by SSL, and that's not Surrey. That's Space Systems of Palo Alto, California. Not Surrey Space, which confused me for a little bit. If you want to watch this launch live, you can go to arianespace.tv and do subscribe to twitter.com/nextlaunch for, you know, updates if that launch date changes.
Well, that is our one and only launch this week. It's been slow for the past couple of weeks on launches. I'm expecting that they'll start pouring out soon, like a kink in a garden hose. So those are your upcoming spaceflight events. A remarkably short show this week, I think. So let's deal with the show. And obviously, before we go, we want to mention some people on iTunes who have given us favorable reviews once again. I'm still thrilled to see it. We're up to 37, I think.
Yeah.
Now, 37 reviews in total. So we have Chris Radcliffe, whom we were just talking about, Noah Shirk, and Brian TLR15. They all gave us 5-star ratings. So thank you so much. I absolutely love these iTunes reviews. It's my favorite thing to look at. And let's cue the music, all of which is brought to you by Ronald Jenkins. Check him out at ronaldjenkins.com.
If you enjoyed our show, please consider supporting us on Patreon at patreon.com/orbitalpodcast.
And you can connect with us on Twitter and Reddit at Orbital Podcast.
You can send questions and comments to info@theorbitalmechanics.com.
And for more information on this episode, such as show notes and other links, visit our website at theorbitalmechanics.com. And that does it already. So we will see you in 7 days on orbit. Until then, bye.
Goodbye. Goodbye, everybody.